Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and you're listening to The Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites, our weekly look at food, agriculture, and our future here on The Mark Steiner Show. From your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And broadcast on Delmarva Public Radio, WSDL 90.7 FM. And today, and we have a great episode of Soundbites ahead of us today, we're going to have a conversation today about an article called Our Failed Food Movement, and talk about how factory farms are continuing to grow despite calls to end industrialized agriculture. But first, we're about to talk with John Fritz, who is the Washington correspondent for the Baltimore Sun, who wrote an interesting piece called Poultry Industry Critical of O'Malley's Stance on Biofuel. O'Malley, of course, running for the president's Democratic nomination for U.S. president and is in Iowa, where most candidates would be at this moment, if not New Hampshire. John, good to talk to you. Welcome back.
Thank you.
So I was trying to remember, and I was read your article, and I was going through some old stuff and thinking about, you know, what has O'Malley said before, like the governor said before about biofuels? This is semi-new territory for him.
It is, and that's sort of to be expected, right? It's more a federal issue, really, than a state issue. He did take some stances. He certainly had taken a lot of stances that have made environmentalists happy on renewable energy, so requiring that the energy that we consume in Maryland, that some portion of that come from solar and wind, and he has done some real innovative and leading stuff on that that's made environmentalists happy. But what he's been less forthcoming on, in part because he didn't have to be, is this renewable fuel standard, which is far more controversial and I think divides environmentalists a little bit. They like the idea of biofuels, but they're not thrilled about biofuels that come from corn, namely ethanol, and that happens to be the largest renewable fuel that's out there right now.
Well, this is a, you know, candidates, no matter what they ever might have said before in the past and where it might have gone for them, once they get to Iowa, things change.
This is true. It's an important
right?
constituency. Corn is the largest crop in Iowa, and so it's a really big deal. They're extremely organized. They have former governors, former senators that are involved with swaying the politicians who come through running for president. Everybody meets with ethanol. In fact, when Hillary Clinton first went out on the road after she first announced, one of the first meetings she held was with the ethanol folks in Iowa. And so it's a very powerful constituency without question in that state.
So but let's talk about the politics of this. I mean, Governor Martin O'Malley, for the most part, especially on the Purdue side, has had a very close relationship with that family. And with people surrounding that family politically and legally, and took a really strong stance during the lawsuit the University of Maryland brought. Some farmers were upset with him because of his phosphorus management tool. But this is interesting because corn is also big in Maryland. It feeds poultry, and it's also a major crop here. And so this is the point of departure. And I wonder how hard a time O'Malley's having with this.
In some sense, yeah, I think you're right. I think, I think the relationship between O'Malley and poultry is always a little hard to dissect. I think some people would argue that he worked pretty hard to court their favor and never really got it. There have been times when I think the administration was aligned with poultry. You mentioned the lawsuit. You know, there were these emails that I think came out, I forget when, maybe during the first term, that sort of showed him trying to at least keep the lines of communication open with the poultry industry out on the shore. And so I think it's fair to say that he worked hard to at least hear them, and there were policies that they liked. And it was, you're right, the corn is a factor in Maryland, but it's not like poultry. Poultry is a huge deal for the state, obviously. It's by far the largest crop, if you can call it that, here in Maryland. And so any politician statewide is going to take care of those guys. Certainly, Senator Mikulski is another one who often is talking about our chicken farmers here in Maryland. And so he was pretty close, at least tried to be pretty close with poultry. It's interesting that they have very quickly called this out and turned on him a little bit with it. That's not unexpected because this is a top issue for them. And particularly, my sense of this is not so much the farmers, but the producers, which is namely Purdue. Because my sense of this is that the farmers grow corn a little bit themselves and
right.
and so forth. But what we're mainly talking about here is the producers, which, again, in Maryland, the big guy is Purdue.
And so it's the producers, along with the American fuel and petrochemical manufacturers, who make up this Smarter Fuel Future group, that oppose this because they don't want the renewable fuel standards in there at all.
That's right.
Right.
Well, it's an interesting group. It's the producers. It's also the farmers that are actually a part of this group. This group is huge. It's got a lot of folks. It's also the environmentalists. There are a fair number of environmentalists who take issue, particularly with ethanol production, right? So it's, when I talked about the environmentalists being a little bit split on this, I think environmentalists like the idea of renewable fuel standard, but there's a lot of concern about the environmental impact from ethanol production. So when O'Malley was first elected governor and came in, there was the transition committee report on environment. There was a lot of talk about renewable fuel standards and concern that if the Obama administration, continued to push renewable fuel standard, that would lead to more corn crop production in Maryland. Environmentalists don't like that because corn is a quote-unquote leaky crop. A lot of the fertilizer that gets put down for corn does not get absorbed by the plant. Stays in the ground, and then when it rains, it runs into the bay ultimately. And so there's concern about ethanol among environmentalists as well as the oil industry. So it's an interesting bunch of folks. That said, the renewable fuel standard, which is the broader thing, which includes other renewable fuels, that is pretty widely liked by environmental groups.
So I'm trying to figure this out then. Is this like a semi-contradiction on the former governor's position, since he wanted to ease fuel standards when he was mayor, a governor?
I think that the poultry industry and the people who are opposed to it would characterize it that way. I'm not sure I would. I think it's a more nuanced than that. I think that O'Malley didn't say much about this really as governor, and now he's come out and taken this stance, very strong stance, in support of it. So I think it's a little more nuanced. The industry would sell it as a flip-flop. My read on it is that it's not really that strong. It's more just that he was fairly quiet about it during governor, which isn't unexpected because the governor wouldn't really weigh into this issue. And now he has taken a stance that his home state industry really doesn't like. A very important constituency in the first nominating state in the nation, Iowa, really does like. So that's more where I think it is. There's one letter that the governor wrote during a drought in 2012 when corn prices were extraordinarily high. He and Governor Markle of Delaware sent a letter to the Obama administration asking them to ease up a little bit on the requirements from the renewable fuel standard out of concern about the high price of corn and the impact that was having on the poultry industry. But that letter, I think, was sort of specific and limited to the drought and didn't really reflect O'Malley's overall stance. At least that's what O'Malley's aides say. And there's nothing really in the letter to indicate otherwise.
And I guess this I'm really interested in this, both in terms of the environment and the question of the agriculture, because so much, it seems, whether it's the agriculture here in Maryland or whether it's in Iowa, is built around corn. I mean, it's built around corn because you have to feed the chickens, and it's built around corn because you have to feed the biofuel. It's not so much about feeding us; it's about feeding
the industry.
Yeah, that's
absolutely right. I mean, that's why the poultry producers don't like this, because the higher the price of corn, the more they have to spend on their feed. And again, it is true. Corn is. It's not an insignificant part of the state's agricultural economy. I forget where it ranks. I looked it up when I wrote the story. I think it's maybe third or fourth. It tends to be, in the top five or ten of pretty much any state's agricultural product. It just so happens that Maryland has this unique thing where poultry is so far and above. Not only is it ranked one, but the amount of money coming in, the amount of farm receipts coming in for poultry is just astronomically larger than corn in this state.
So what is poultry saying? I mean, they're just curious. How much are they assuming or making us or saying to us that it's going to raise the price of their product?
Yeah, I mean, so their statement they put out.
It's already pretty cheap.
It's true. I think they're throwing everything at the wall on this. So I think they're noting that prices will go up. I don't know that they've said, you know, by how much exactly. It kind of depends on a lot of different factors, right? So it's sort of hard to nail that down. It's both the renewable fuel standard and the yield for the crop in any given year and so forth. But, you know, they're arguing that, yeah, the price of chicken you throw on your grill is going to go up substantially if we keep raising the amount of biofuel that gets blended in. You know, they're also making the environmental argument. They're arguing that, look, you know, a lot of environmentalists have a problem with ethanol.
But maybe you're saying Purdue is making the environmental argument?
This group that I think you mentioned, the group that includes the poultry folks and everything else, they will certainly point out...
Smarter fuel future.
Yeah, they'll point... Yeah, exactly. They'll point out the concerns that some environmentalists have raised about
right.
corn growth. and they'll also, you know, the other argument they're making is deals with, believe it or not, another member of this coalition is the boat motor industry. Apparently there's some controversy about how well this fuel runs in motors... That make boats go on the Chesapeake Bay and elsewhere, and so that's another point they talk about, that it does damage to the engine. Look, I'm not an expert on that stuff. The group told me it's true, the corn grower told me it's not true. I guess we have to pull out our boat and put some gas in it to see. But they're throwing many different arguments at the wall about why they think this is a bad idea. And it's also worth noting that sort of the broader context of this is that the Obama administration has proposed reducing the level of biofuel mixed into gasoline, right? And that's kind of what this is all about. Earlier this year, they proposed reducing that level in part because of a recognition that the industry just isn't geared up enough yet to hit the targets that were set by Congress when they proposed this idea in 2005 and then later in 2007. So the Obama administration, in sort of a recognition that the industry isn't up to speed yet and can't meet the target set, has proposed reducing the mix of biofuels in gasoline. And that is part of what this is all about, right? So the industries, the poultry and other industries, very much like that idea, and some others are not against it. O'Malley came out and said he was against that, very specifically said that he thought that the target should continue to go up, should not be going down.
I mean, it's all very convoluted in some ways when you kind of look at the back and forth of the argument about biofuels, that you know, like the argument without biofuels, and then we have to have more barrels per year, and that we have to use the other filler that is more, which is MTBEs, which is dangerous to the environment, yet... When I also read stat I read this morning, thinking about your conversation, is that 23% of all the American corn crop is produced for ethanol, but it only takes up replaces 4% of the gasoline consumption. So I mean, it's all really mixed, and it made me think that in the world of industrial corn, makes very strange bedfellows.
It is. It is mixed. You're right. It is. It's a fascinating thing because there's parts of it that everybody likes, and there's parts of it that people don't like, and there's parts of it where I think there's a great deal of confusion, frankly, even among the candidates. I think that there are folks that aren't totally clear on this issue. But I think, you know, when these folks go through Iowa, they quickly have to get up to speed on it.
Yeah, they do.
It's an issue that's super important out there.
I mean, I can see that Bernie Sanders has not figured out what his position is yet. The governor and the secretary seem to have. What about the Republicans? Are they fairly pro-biofuel?
They are fairly pro, yes. I think Republicans many of them. I think there's actually been a few folks who have suggested that, hey, we need to rethink this. But I think that nobody is speaking out very aggressively against it. Most Republicans have done the same thing Democrats have done. Clinton, her stance comes from an editorial she wrote in the Des Moines Register, in which she talked a lot about the renewable fuel standard, but was careful not to really talk about the makeup of the fuel. She didn't really get into ethanol specifically. And so some people were sort of reading the tea leaves there that, you know, maybe she was leaving the options open for different kinds of fuel, ones that are more acceptable to the environmentalists. But that's not totally clear. O'Malley,
right.
You know, he went to an ethanol plant and stood there and held up corn grains and talked about being opposed to the Obama administration's effort to lower the mix amount. So he's pretty clear. And, yes, as you know, Sanders told a group that he wasn't really sure about it. And I checked with the campaign again before writing that story, and their position remains that they're still looking into it. I think they're probably wrestling with this tug between, you know, the environmentalists, which is a core constituency for Democrats, and some of the other constituencies involved.
Right, and I think all that plays into it. And I mean, I was going to make some bad pun, but I won't do it. See how this all shucks out, but we'll.
There you go. Right. I like it.
But I find it really fascinating watching this, and knowing it's mostly. I mean, the industry really opposes this here, but the farmers do not in many ways, because as you said, many farmers in the state of Maryland who may grow chickens for Purdue or Tyson or anybody else also grow corn. They have that to make ends meet.
That's right.
So this is going to make their money go up no matter what happens.
There's a way to look at that. That's certainly true. And I think that what happens is those farmers end up selling the corn back to Purdue often. I think Purdue is really the one. Purdue and the other producers. It's not just Purdue. There's other folks in the region. But Purdue is the big gun. I think you're right. I think that they're the ones that really get stuck with it more than anything.
Well, it's always good to talk to you. This is really interesting. We'll keep on the campaign trail with you over the coming months, obviously, and as the Soundbites pieces, we'll bring you back for that as well.
I'm looking forward to it. Thanks.
I am too. John Fritzy is the Washington correspondent for the Baltimore Sun. We'll be linking to the article on our pages on the web, Poultry Industry Critical of O'Malley's Stance on Biofuel. John, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Soundbites, our weekly look at food, agriculture, and our future here on The Mark Steiner Show. From your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And broadcast on Delmarva Public Radio, WSDL 90.7 FM. We have to take a very brief break. On our way to break, we're hearing Wild Thing by the Troggs, which hit number one on this day in 1966. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and you're listening to Soundbites, our weekly look at food, agriculture, and our future here on The Mark Steiner Show. From your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And broadcast on Delmarva Public Radio, WSDL 90.7 FM. That's Mustang Sally by Buddy Guy. Buddy Guy was born today in 1936. It's good to have you all here with us on the Mark Steiner Show on Soundbites, and we're going to have a more in-depth look at things we've been talking about for a long time here on the program, which has to do with the new food movement and factory farms in this country, and the mythology on both sides, where this world is taking us, and why it's so difficult for us as seen to put our hands around this intractable issue. We are joined by Carol Morrison once again, a transitional farmer who went from producing industrial contract chickens to her pasture-raised chickens at the Bird's Eye View Farm in Pocomoke City. Expanding her operation there. Jacqueline Patterson is with us, who is director of the NAACP's Climate Justice Initiative, and Nathaniel Johnson, a food writer at Grist, who teaches at the University of California, Berkeley, in the Graduate School of Journalism, and author of All Natural, A Skeptic's Quest to Discover If the Natural Approach to Diet, Childbirth, Healing, and the Environment Really Keeps Us Healthier and Happier. So Nathaniel, Jackie, and Jacqueline, and Carol, welcome. Good to have you with us here.
Thank you.
Great to be here.
Great to have you all with us. So let me just begin with this. The Food and Water Watch came out with this report that showed that there's been this exponential growth in factory farming in industrial agriculture in the United States. They pointed out that there's been a 20% growth in livestock between 2002 and 2012. It's producing more manure by hundreds of millions of tons than they ever have in 2012. And dairy cows on industrial farms have increased by half, and on. And that there's been a real growth here, despite the growth in what we call alternative agriculture or the food-to-table movement and organic farms that are picking up in people are buying across the country, and it's picking up steam everywhere. So there seems to be a contradiction here, Carol. I mean, between what we the move to kind of deindustrialize agriculture, but the inability of organic agriculture and what we call the new food movement to really answer the questions about both the soil and the food people have to eat. What's your analysis of what you think is happening here?
Well, I think the biggest thing with industrial agriculture, with them growing, is the most anticipated Pacific trade agreement. I do know that in my area, the poultry industry is gearing up for that. So that is has been an incentive here. Poultry companies here are actually giving incentives, cash bonuses, for people to build new chicken houses. And what we're seeing here is not just your, you know, farm adding on a chicken house or two. We are seeing what I call CAFO developers, and these are people who are coming in, obviously have plenty of money, buying up prime farmland and building these developments of chicken houses. They have no tie to the land, no tie to the communities. It's just industrial chicken houses. Average size that we're seeing now, or I'll say on the low side, is six of these huge buildings. And these buildings can house up to 60,000 chickens apiece. So we're seeing this development going on. We're seeing farmland disappearing. And I do believe a lot of it has to do with the trade agreement.
So it seems, though, Jacqueline, that with this growth of the organic movement, of farmers' markets, people really trying to find a different way of living and eating, that it's not having a dent on food production or how most of us have to buy our food.
So, yes, you're right. I'm excited by the number of models and the way that the concept of local food movement is taking off, but it definitely hasn't reached scale. But I feel that the trajectory and the pace is such that we're getting there. More and more folks are looking at having local control, building local economies, strengthening local economies, and recognizing the important connection between growing food locally and both our health and our economy. So I'm certainly seeing a lot more interest and a lot more development along the stage, but it certainly hasn't reached scale yet. But I do think it's heading in that direction.
And, so, and Nathaniel, I mean, let me just give you some contradictions here. One of the articles that I read this morning was one that that Carol sent me, why everyone who's sure about food philosophy is wrong. And you know, when we look at people who are trying to, say, buy cucumbers, and they in the state of Maryland, Maryland-grown cucumbers, according to this article, that produces 7,800 pounds a year per acre. In Florida, 26,000 per acre. And a lot of cucumbers brought here are grown on these small farms who sell them at markets and other places. So therein lies part of the issue, that people, when they go to buy their food, buy things from industrial agriculture, whether it's organic or non-organic, because the price is cheaper and kept that way.
Right. That's the one major indicator. You know, that's the thing that you see when you go shopping. You see the price tag, and it's very hard to see any other signal beyond that. That's the thing that's really going to affect what you buy. And then it's really hard to discriminate between all the marketing that's surrounding the food and what's real. But the price tag, you know, the price tag is real. And so that has a tremendous effect on what people actually do.
And it does have an effect on what people will use and the effect in the industry. I heard what you're saying, Carol, about TPP and all the things that were in the Food and Water Watch report about what this government does to kind of ensure that factory farms can grow, and that and that there are the rules that kind of allow that kind of pollution to take place. All that exists, but there's something always been missing, and what's missing is how we eat without that, how we eat without the industrial farms. How is that possible unless we do something as radical as one of the articles is pointing out, of stop or pulling back on what we either grow and eat when it comes to meat, including the chickens and the eggs that you grow. Do you know what I'm saying? And people are saying that is part of the heart of the problem.
Well, Mark, I'm going to kind of throw a monkey wrench into the whole works here.
Well, I wouldn't expect nothing less of you.
Far be it from me to do anything like that. sorry, folks. here locally, okay, just on my farm alone, I've had more and more people stopping by the farm to buy my eggs. And they are telling me, I had a lady just 2 days ago stop here to buy eggs. And she asked me why I was selling them so cheaply. And I was like, well, what do you mean? And she said, well, your eggs are cheaper now than what they are down at Walmart. You know, so that tells me right there that an excuse has been used across the country where, you know, sadly we had the avian flu outbreak and so many laying hens were either died or euthanized. I mean, we're talking millions. That was the perfect excuse to raise egg prices and to continue raising them. Well, you know what? I'm just a small farmer here trying to make a living, and I'm making a hell of a living and don't need to raise my egg prices any higher because I'm satisfied with my return.
How much do you sell your eggs for?
If they pick them up at the farm, they get them for $4 a dozen.
Right, and most.
So I am becoming competitive. Not that I have any thought in my mind that I can replace an industrial, company, and produce on the scale that they do. But for a localized food system, I can contribute to it.
And
I've always said, not that people, don't need help with being fed around the world. If I can feed my neighbor, I'm happy. And I think we gear up too much for we have to feed the world.
We do have to feed the nation, though. And I think that $4 a dozen is a reasonable price for eggs for a lot of people in America. But
I'm still making money off of that.
No, I understand.
So why do I need to rape the public?
But most people, when they go to buy eggs like yours at a farmer's market or in a supermarket, they're going to be charged $6 a dozen.
Correct.
And who's going to pay $6
this
a dozen for eggs?
And I would put that down to, depending on the area of the country that you're in, how hard it is to get the resources needed to produce that particular item of food, and what your costs are. I mean, it's not the same we don't get reduced prices on feed. We don't get reduced prices on anything. We don't get subsidies. The industrial system is set up so it can't fail. The government highly subsidizes industrial agriculture. If we look at corn subsidies, at bean subsidies, any of the grains, we look at the public health costs that are paid by taxpayers, we look at the environmental cost that is paid by taxpayers, it's private industry that taxpayers are carrying. Nobody carries me. And yet they still are making money, hand over fist.
So let me ask this question, and Jackie and then Nathan, please jump in, Nathaniel.
Mm-hmm.
So what has to change to change the paradigm? I mean, when you look at Food and Water Watch's report about the growth in in industrial farms in this country, and it's huge. I mean, it's exponential leaps. I mean, the number of hogs on a factory farm increased by one-third. Average farm size swelled to 70% from 1997 to 2012. The number of broiler chickens on factory farms rose 80% in the same period.
Correct.
To more than 1 billion. So,
yep.
But that's our diet in many ways, Jackie. And so the question is, can that change? Should it change? How do we get there?
Yes. So I do think it can change. I think it should change. And I think that the ways that, I mean, just taking a few examples, some of the concrete policy mechanisms that are being put into place to support more healthy eating from better locally grown sources include the fact that you can now take your food assistance program card or vouchers or whatever in certain states and actually purchase from a farmer's market now. So that's a major kind of innovation that brings access to low-income folks who are able to go and buy healthy foods at farmer's markets. Now we just see a lot more, even in the way of kind of marketing around locally grown food and seeing that it's more less of a kind of what people saw as a fad or a hippie notion, but more of a conversation. When I'm talking to community groups, we're really talking about the importance of locally grown foods. Go on. I thought someone was trying to come
no,
in.
No, go ahead. Finish, Jackie. Finish what you're saying. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So I do feel that there is observe that there has been a culture shift and following that, some policy shifts and mechanisms for increasing access, and that there has been more of a conversation where there's a greater embrace, definitely a ways to go, of the importance of the local food movement as a key kind of way that we should be shifting society. So I do feel like, see that we're on the increase as it relates to that. There's certainly factory farms and big ag continue to dominate, but bit by bit, just as we see with the energy sector making that shift and now making that shift at scale, I see the food system following the same route.
And Nathaniel, so go ahead, Nathaniel. Jump in.
Well, I think, I mean, if Carolyn's right, nothing needs to change. I mean, economics, if she can undercut the price of Walmart without subsidies, then, I mean, that model will expand across the world.
That's not always the case, though.
That's how economics works. I mean, unless you have some secret formula that you're not willing to share with anybody else, there are plenty of people who are willing to who would be willing to make money. You know, But the fact is that you may live in a strange place in New York. You know, right now, and the price of eggs for a dozen is $1.60, and that's if you take out the subsidies the government pays. It increases a bit, but not a whole bunch. You know, you're up to around $2. So there's a couple. I think the main failure of the food movement has been a real willingness to grapple with the realities of economics and to really understand that there's got to be a dual focus here. You know, we do have to take into account the importance of improving the environment, but we also have a real duty to provide good food at affordable prices to low-income people. And if we don't manage those trade-offs in a reasonable way, we're going to fail. Yes, we're seeing a big increase in local food, but we're seeing an even bigger increase in industrial farming.
And I begin to wonder as I listen to the debates whether people who support more healthy food that's locally controlled, that's not just industrially controlled by large corporations, whether we are throw the baby out with the bathwater by opposing everything that's genetically modified, that you know, there are all kinds of issues around the genetically modified corn and soy and the pesticide resistance and what that's doing to bees and what it's doing to the soil and to the food that goes to the animals that we eat and more. And those are real issues that we have to address. On the other hand, certain genetically modified foods and other things being developed could enhance agriculture and make it easier to grow things and actually feed people. So, I mean, so it's a very complex thing. And do we make this GMO debate too simple in our just in our opposition?
Well, yeah, I think so. I mean, I think first of all, the GMOs, there's really no evidence that they're doing anything to bees. And you know, there's been things floated about questions about animals, but you know, there's been a huge review of animal health. You know, we've had millions and millions of animals in the U.S. eating GMOs for the last 30 years, and they've been healthy. So you know, even the things that look like they might be real issues may actually end up being bathwater. I do think I would like to just see the conversation shift from GMOs, you know, this gigantic thing, to like what breeding techniques do we want in our food system, and what kind of products, you know, will actually be useful? Do we want products that will help us reduce pesticide spraying? Do we want, there's a tomato and pepper on the shelf right now at Florida State University that they made resistant to fungus and disease, which could reduce fungicide spraying by quite a bit. But it's just one of those things that, you know, the industry says, well, people are worried about this. We don't want to take it through the regulatory process.
So, Carol, what, how would you weigh in on that?
I kind of agree and I kind of disagree. I've got mixed feelings on the GMOs. I'll be quite honest about it, and I'm not that knowledgeable. I do have some knowledge of it. I think my biggest question is, you know, of course we have animals that have been healthy from eating the GMO grains, but we have to remember that animal lived a very short life. Does the meat from those animals have a long-term effect on the people who consume that meat? And I don't think there is enough information there. You know, we again, it's this instantaneous stuff. Well, look at the animals. They're healthy. Yeah, they are. But how long before they were slaughtered? You know, a chicken, it only takes 7 weeks. So we really don't know what effect it had on the health of that chicken. Or, you know, a cow, what's it take, 18 months to feed out a cow? So I don't think we have enough information there to make sound judgments to say it is okay, it's not okay.
Yeah, that's right. I wouldn't. I'm not using the animal statistics to make a case.
I'm just saying, do we have the research there, and can it be shown that there are no long-term effects on the human population that consumes these things?
Yeah, and it, of course that can't be shown. You know that, and so the important thing is to ask: is this safe? Because it's impossible to prove that something is safe. But whether it's as safe or more safe or less safe than the alternative. And we have lots of different breeding techniques that we're using right now for our crops and our animals. And one of the real paradoxes that's occurred with all of the controversy around GMOs is that, you know, these big corporations have turned to alternative breeding techniques. For instance, the use of mutagenesis, where we apply radioactivity to seeds or mutagenic chemicals to seeds, has increased in use quite a bit. And so,
with very little regulation and oversight, I might add.
No regulation.
Right.
No regulation.
Right.
Whereas
right.
GMOs do have a level of regulation. So, I mean, rather than simply saying, again, GMOs or no GMOs, I think we should be looking at the specific case. You know, is this a product that we want? Is this useful for our food system? Will it help us bring good food to people who couldn't afford it otherwise will help us improve our environment and reduce the dependency on fossil fuels and greenhouse gas emissions. And the same thing, I think, when we're looking at industrial agriculture, we need to be asking about these trade-offs, not just, you know, is factory farming good or bad, but is it better or worse than the alternative?
I think the thing is that, you know, just as a consumer, I expect to be some level of trust there as to whether something is good for me or not. I think all consumers depend on our government to ensure that things are good for you. And I don't see this happening because it can't be said that it's good.
So I want to come up, take a different tack here for a moment as I try to cover a lot of ground here in the time we have together in this first parts of our conversation that I hope is ongoing. But Jackie, I mean, one of the things that I, you know, when you look at the increasing amount of people in this country, especially in communities of color, that have fewer resources, less access to food, the question becomes what kind of system do you have to develop, both in terms of public policy and in terms of farming that's affected by that policy, that begins to feed the people that need to be fed in this country?
Yes. So what kind of systems do we need to have to be able to feed the people who need to be fed in this country?
Right.
That's what you said, right?
Right.
Yes. So, yes. I mean, I think, and I guess I would add to that question, and I think you said in the way that they need to be fed, and I think that's key in terms of making sure that the foods that people are eating have nutritional value and that they are not non-toxic. And so this is one of the key questions that we're working with. As we see now that a number of the communities we're working in are living in food deserts where they're more likely to get their food from a corner store with foods that largely have just literally no nutritional value whatsoever, than certainly a farmer's market and even a supermarket where they can actually get fruits and vegetables. So when we're talking about food justice, we are very much looking for, the very examples I gave with being able to have across the board, not just in select states, where folks can use their food supplement or the food assistance program credits to be able to go to farmers markets to get food. We also want to see more support for community supported agriculture so that there is a greater, so there's more access to community supported to local foods. And so we want to see more work with whether it's Department of Agriculture and urban areas, Department of Housing and Urban Development, where they're actively supporting farmers markets and so forth, so that they're better developed. We're seeing in Washington, D.C., for example, there's a person who's actually who's coordinating and making sure that he can bring in folks from rural D.C., rural Maryland, and rural Virginia, so that that food can come into the urban areas in D.C. who normally wouldn't even see a farmer's market. So we want to see more support for that kind of thing. And certainly these larger issues around the Trans-Pacific Partnership and the Farm Bill and other larger kind of macro-level policies, certainly major reform is needed there, but those are some of the policies that we're working on at the more local level.
Can I just say, I mean, I think that there's a clear need to provide more food aid for people in this country that need it. Food is just a basic human right, and everybody, it's just a crime that people in the United States are still food insecure. And providing enough food aid can just be such a massive supplement to people's incomes and allowing them to pay the rent and pay their medical bills if they're really struggling to do that. But I think also on top of that, you know, we're sometimes a little bit quick in the food movement, again, as I mentioned earlier, to push economics to the side. And we do have to acknowledge that industrial agriculture has made a real impact in lowering food prices for people who couldn't afford it otherwise. You know, the fact that we're talking about $2 a dozen eggs versus $4 a dozen eggs, I mean, this is a big difference for people who are living paycheck to paycheck. You know, and in terms of climate as well, we're talking about an increase in factory farmed animals. But you know, I've been working on this series on writing about meat, and I was just shocked to find out that the period where we had the most farm animals in this country was the early to mid 1900s. The dairy cattle herd peaked in 1944. There were 25.6 million dairy cows, and now we have 9.2 million dairy cows in this country, and we're producing a third more milk than we were in 1944. So we've seen this massive increase in efficiency, which has meant a massive decrease in greenhouse gas emissions and a massive decrease in the price of milk. These things are not simple, but we do have to grapple with the fact that this system, as ugly as it is in many cases, is also providing some real benefits.
I guess, but go ahead, Carol. Let me let you close this out.
I think, too, with what you're saying, if we're going to point out the benefits of industrialized agriculture, then we have to look at the real cost of what this great output really is.
Absolutely.
And is it worth the trade-off that we're doing right now to everything else just to have a great output for a handful of companies in this country?
Yeah, but absolutely. I'm just saying in the food movement we talk an awful lot about the costs and very little about the benefits. And the benefits aren't just limited to a few companies. It's also limited to the people who are living paycheck to paycheck. It's also expressed in a decrease in greenhouse gas emissions.
The other thing I would add to there is that there's food justice, but incorporated within food justice is economic justice. And economic justice means that not only are we looking at prices, but we're actually looking at people being able to afford to buy their food from wherever they want to buy it from. And so that's one of the reasons why we really are looking at strengthening local economies, so that we're not seeing and building local food movements in that sense is also an economic justice driver.
I don't want to come across as a defender of industrial agriculture. I just feel like these issues aren't brought up. I mean, Jackie, would you advocate for going to $4 eggs across the board?
Those kind of questions take it out of the context of a larger social justice movement, and that's the point that Al was trying to make. I might advocate for $5 a dozen if we're actually having people who aren't necessarily dependent on food assistance to be able to get their food, because we're all gainfully employed and we can choose where we get our food from. That might be, and that might be something that even the folks with low income would say the same. Like, I would rather pay more and actually have gainfully employed. I think we just need to look at it from a larger systemic. And that's what I mean.
So, we're almost out of time. So let me kind of turn to Carol. I'm sorry, we're almost out of time. But Carol, go ahead, and we can make this the final thought.
If we're going to talk about the across the board economics, let's say that who can afford what. And my story will be short. As a contract industrial producer, I could not afford to go to the store and buy the chicken that I produced. So we need to take a look at, is the farmer making a living?
Right.
That is food justice as well, when a farmer cannot afford to go and buy what they are producing.
I think we're getting to the heart of some of the matter here, and I think that and a lot of this is out of the hands of the farmer or the consumer,
And really,
oh, I agree.
And really is in the hands of those who contort or write and create the policies that allow different agricultures to grow or not. I mean, I think that's, I mean, that to me is the center of it all. I mean, we would the because industrial agriculture, other agriculture didn't just form itself out of the out of whole cloth or out of the ether. I mean, part of it was public policy that allowed things to grow, and public policy doesn't public policy mm-hmm. have a lot to do with what the future will look like.
Oh, I definitely think so.
However, you think that future should be designed,
right? So, I mean, I think we have if we really wanted to do. Kind of the food utopia that I'd like to see would be where we make food a human right, and we make it a commons rather that this is rather than it being a commodity subject to economics, that it's something that we all get regardless of our income level. But that is just never going to happen. I mean, we're talking about utopian politics rather than democratic politics. Utopia is a good vision to hold in the future. But
let me push a little bit further as we end this. I mean, Jackie, push the question whether it really is utopia. I mean, when we're talking about when you watch the food, the desire for affordable and healthy food growing in the poorest neighborhoods, along with the people who already are buying it in middle class and upper middle class neighborhoods that are mostly white. If that comes together in some kind of – there is power there in terms of moving a shift to say that we're powerless to change it, I think is also kind of a mistake. Jackie?
Yeah, and I mean, so I've seen – I mean, I'm seeing it happen in the small places, and I guess that's the reason why I can talk about it in a way that isn't necessarily utopian, but it's what I've actually seen, although certainly these are small microcosms within a much larger – system, and they don't necessarily all add up to a large system. But I've seen from the landslide community in Pittsburgh to small communities in Kansas City where folks are growing their own food. They have chicken coops where they're raising their own chickens, where there's farmers markets that are, you know, where local farmers are all coming together and providing food not only to the communities but to schools. So I'm seeing this already, and I can only work on making sure that it goes to scale. Right now, I'm sending at this moment an email to all of our folks with the assistance the EPA is offering through their local food, local places program, where they're providing $80,000 in technical assistance to communities around doing local food program, or $800,000. I'm sorry. Between EPA, USDA, CDC, and others. So I want to see more of those policies in place, because I don't necessarily think it's – I think we can actually get closer to it, even if it's utopian. Imagine that becomes the norm. So.
Well, there's so much more to go through here, but I do hope that that you all will agree to come back for continuing discussions as we kind of wrestle with where the future is going. You all are kind of serious activists, deep thinkers, and have been involved in this for a long time. And I want to thank Carol Morrison, who at Bird's Eye View Farm, who in Pocomoke, who's shown that you can walk out of the industrial system and create a world on the land that you have, and took great risks to do it and has done it, she and her husband. And Carol, great to have you with us as usual. Thank you so much. Always good to have you with us.
Thank you.
And Jackie Patterson, director at NAACP Climate Change Justice Initiative. And always great to have you with us as well, Jackie, to bring your insights and the work that you do. And Nathaniel Johnson writes for Grist, but also is, of course, a professor at the University of California, Berkeley School of Journalism, and wrote the book All Natural, Skeptics' Quest to Discover If the Natural Approach to Diet, Childbirth, Healing, and Environment Really Keeps Us Healthier and Happier. Long title, but good book. Nathaniel.
They have the content in the title.
Really, I know, right? Nathaniel, thanks so much once again to have you with us. Thank you all so much.
Thanks so much.
The Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites are a production of the Center for Emerging Media, made possible in part by a grant from the Town Creek Foundation. Our producers are Mark Gunnery and Stephanie Mavronis. Our engineer at WEAA is Andre Melton. Our engineer at Public Radio Delmarva is Christopher Rank. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, and find out information from the interviews we are doing on this program, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. You can also listen to and download our podcast on iTunes. For Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, and for WSDL 90.7 FM, Delmarva Public Radio, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.